Strange, Punks and Drunks and Flicks and Kicks, written and read by Richard Strange. Episode 8. We were delighted by the passion and polarity of opinion that our first record had aroused, but we would have preferred the support of the majority of the mainstream press rather than the idiosyncratic rump. However, given the nature of the music we were making, we were more or less satisfied, and besides, we still had an ace up our sleeve. The NBC special about Doctors of Madness, which was about to be aired coast to coast across the USA on network TV. In anticipation of this, Brian sent a telegram to the heads of all the major record labels, urging them to cancel whatever plans they had for Saturday night and watch Weekend instead. On the Monday following the broadcast, Brian was in the office before lunchtime, an unusual occurrence. He was there to take the calls coming from American record company moguls, who would all try to outdo each other by phoning London before that rival had even got out of bed. Strangely, the telephone stayed quiet. After lunch, Brian sat there again waiting, but again, no calls. "They're playing hard to get," he said. "They want me to call them. Fuck 'em, let them stew." That was his appraisal of the situation. "They always pay more when they call you." The next day was the same, and by Wednesday, Brian was so perplexed and agitated that he phoned a friend in New York to see what the reaction to the program had been. "Brian, it was a fucking disaster from start to finish, man. It was a complete assassination job on you, on Justin, on the band, everyone. It transpired that the film had been edited in such a way so as to make the band look like a talentless bunch of no-hopers being manipulated by a pair of Machiavellian Svengalis, if you'll excuse the mixed metaphor. Every shot was designed to reinforce this theme. The only live shots of the band were the ones taken at near-empty gigs to pitiful audience reaction. The out-of-tune rehearsals were shown as proof of lack of musical talent, and the footage from the Olympia show was used to illustrate the fact that we were the beneficiaries of a crass but powerful hype machine. The shots of Morrison and de Villeneuve were all filmed as they tucked into lobster and champagne and were juxtaposed with me being interviewed in front of the one-bar electric fire. The voice of Greg droned monotonously over every picture, implying that we were a sort of manufactured monkey-style marketing exercise rather than a band who had been playing live for 2 years before Morrison de Villeneuve came along. All in all, we were totally and utterly stitched up by the duplicitous Greg and his amiable crew, who had come with an agenda and cut the film accordingly. Brian was livid, and we were devastated. I've always had a great capacity to accept disappointments, to rail and to grieve and then get on with real life. That is what we had to do after the NBC fiasco. We had to put the idea of an imminent US release of the record out of our minds and concentrate on the UK and Europe. Unfortunately, this meant Polydor getting the marketing of the record right, and to get the marketing right, it was essential that Polydor understood the band. They had to get it. In popular music, where genre is all, to be non-generic is commercial and critical suicide. Polydor didn't understand it. They didn't know what it was. Consequently, they had no idea how to market us. Pop music is very unforgiving in one crucial sense. If you aren't shifting product, you're a waste of time, money, vinyl, and shelf space. Very few people in the business are prepared to stick their necks out and go for the long haul or the oddball act, since for the most part, people in the record industry lack both taste and critical judgment. They seek consensus and the approval of their peers, since they are essentially herd animals. This is why they hunt in packs. When two record companies want to sign the same act, all the other companies are de facto interested too. Not necessarily because there is a unique quality in the act, simply the act has been legitimized by the interest of the first two companies. In April, we returned to Europe to capitalize on our earlier success there, and we toured France and the Benelux countries extensively. By now, we were earning better money, and we could afford to take a proper truck and a driver in addition to our regular road crew. Somehow or other, a guy named Martin Griffin was pointed our way for the job, and I took against him immediately. He was a big, powerful-looking guy with a huge handlebar moustache and an opinion on every subject. He was garrulous and cocky and had a chip on his shoulder. All in all, he was way too much like me, apart from the moustache. I was horrified at the prospect of this guy, who everybody called Drumbo, being on the road with us for the next month. I tried every avenue to get him replaced, but he was the only person who was available and willing to do the job for the money we could afford. It went without saying that all the road crew were earning considerably more than the band at this point, and Drumbo, with his HGV license, earned more than anyone. That tour took us to every major French, Belgian and Dutch city, and we were playing to good-sized crowds who were, for the most part, extravagantly appreciative. In Paris, we played more consecutive shows at Le Bataclan even than Roxy Music had managed, and by the time we reached the large provincial cities such as Lyon, Marseille and Bordeaux, the word has already reached them that we were hot and we were selling out everywhere. The record charted first in Belgium and then in France, and we were getting dream reviews for all the gigs we played. Drumbo came and sat with me in a bar one night and we started chatting. 6 hours later, we were the best of friends. I realised that my animosity towards him was totally unfounded and was based purely on the fact that I'd recognised him as possessing an ego as large as mine. Since it was the first time this has happened in the touring party, I felt threatened. I was so impressed and amused by Drumbo that I started travelling to gigs with him in the truck, leaving the rest of the band to travel by car. The conversation and the chemicals were so much better with Drumbo. He had a healthy appetite for amphetamine sulfate, and together we consumed vast quantities of the stuff as we thundered across the major roads of Europe. We spoke for hours on end, pausing only to refresh our nostrils every 50 miles or so. Drumbo was a fabulous Falstaffian figure, a true English yeoman. He told me he was really a drummer, but after getting thrown out of Oxford, he took an HGV course and became a bus driver. In those days, of course, you could always drop out because you know you'd always be able to drop back in. That whole tour was enormously enjoyable, both for the pleasure of Drumbo's company and for the success and the acclaim that we were garnering. Arriving back in England, I transferred back to the car to complete the journey home with the band, as Drumbo had to take the truck to the warehouse where we stored the equipment to unload. Exhausted and out of chemicals, Drumbo fell asleep at the wheel on the motorway up from Dover and only woke when he crashed into the central reservation at 70 miles an hour and tore the entire side off the truck and took half a mile of central reservation with him. Miraculously, he survived unscathed. We kept Drumbo on the payroll for the British gigs that were lined up immediately after our return to the UK. In all the madness, he had become my one link to the real world while we were on the road. I've known him for many years now, and he has never given me one bad piece of advice or a single opinion that wasn't thought through. In spring 1976, we did a gig at Middlesbrough Town Hall, a part of our UK tour. We got a call from Martin Hopewell asking if we'd be prepared to let a band called the Sex Pistols support us for that one gig. They were a new so-called punk band that had attracted an inordinate amount of media coverage thanks to the astute manipulation of staged outrages by their self-proclaimed situationist manager, Malcolm McLaren. As yet, they hadn't played any shows outside of London, and McLaren decided it was time for them to start. By this time, we were attracting up to 1,000 people a night. We were really the only band around with any sizable following that was prepared to risk having them on the bill with us. Most of the other bands around were too muso and precious to share a bill with such an anarchic rabble. I liked what I'd heard about their attitude, and we agreed to give them a gig. On arriving at the venue in Middlesbrough, which actually turned out to be a large, drab, Soviet-style functions room underneath the town hall itself, we did the usual stuff a headline band does, soundchecking, dicking around, drinking and chatting to the die-hard fans who arrive at a venue even before the band does, while the surly, pimply-faced quartet sat in the auditorium behaving suitably obnoxiously. They farted, they burped, they yawned extravagantly, and they giggled. We were surprised how weedy they looked, like schoolboys bunking off school, muttering asides to each other that were muttering asides to each other that were designed to aggravate and provoke. We didn't raise to debate, but like an irritating wasp buzzing around a picnic, they were impossible to ignore. They didn't dress as outrageously as we'd been told to expect. Their sole concessions to what became known as the punk look were the spiked-up hair, a few badges, a torn T-shirt, and the odd safety pin. Johnny Rotten, the frontman, had an extraordinary presence and charisma, though, and his nasal whine seemed to have been rehearsed to perfection. Glenn Matlock, the bass player, seemed ordinary and unremarkable. Steve Jones was yobbish, and Paul Cook was just a typical drummer who seemed temperamentally to be just like Peter Dilemma. Eventually, we let them have the stage, and when they realised they didn't have all the equipment they needed, they sheepishly asked if they could borrow some of ours. Urban Blitz flatly refused to lend them his guitar amp, and I think the rest of us were none too keen to let them loose on our equipment. They'd already attracted a certain reputation for trashing any equipment they borrowed, assuming that they didn't steal it. Somehow or other, they did a sound check, and it really was a god-awful racket that they made. It was desultory, half-hearted, out of tune, rhythmically all over the place. The funny thing with the Pistols was that if you took away Rotten's petulant, snotty-nosed vocal delivery and lyrics, you were left with a fairly conventional up-and-down pub rock band. An hour or so later, however, when the punters were in and the Pistols were on stage, they were electric. They spent their entire 25-minute set goading and cajoling the audience, daring them to trash the joint, provoking the most extreme reaction I'd ever seen at a gig. Yet, all the while, the band seemed almost comatose with boredom. It was a great act. The audience watched open-mouthed and wide-eyed. They gobbed and they pogoed that vertical takeoff Tourette's syndrome-inspired dance of the time, and they were putty in the Pistols' hands. Live, the Pistols mixed standards like Iggy Pop's Stooges song I Wanna Be Your Dog and the Monkees' I'm Not Your Stepping Stone with their own nihilistic anthems that would soon make them famous, like Anarchy in the UK and No Feelings. It was a dreadful sensation watching them from the side of the stage and knowing that we couldn't compete. There's a passage in George Melly's excellent autobiography, Owning Up, in which he describes how, when witnessing the hysterical teenage audience reaction to 1950s British rock and roll hero Tommy Steele for the first time, a jazz colleague turned to George and said, "You hear that? That's the death of jazz. We've had it. In 6 months, we'll all be on the breadline." I must confess, that's exactly how I felt watching the Sex Pistols play that night. They were changing the rules and the game was being snatched away from beneath our noses. Right. We followed them on stage after a suitably long interval, hoping that the temperature would cool sufficiently for us to get the audience going again. In truth, the gig we did that night was pretty good, but we knew that we'd not generated one quarter of the excitement that the Sex Pistols had. Our fans came backstage and were enthusiastic as always, and many of them told us that they thought the punk thing would blow itself out in a couple of months. I was neither comforted nor convinced. I was simply jealous. To compound what had been a very bad evening for us, while driving back to the hotel after the gig, we realised that we had all had some money stolen from our clothes in the dressing room while we'd been on stage. It didn't require Sherlock Holmes to deduce that, while we were performing, the Pistols had gone through our pockets and scarpered. They didn't take a great deal. In truth, there wasn't much to take, just a few quid from each of us at most, but we were livid. We weren't the final victims of that truculent, snotty-nosed bunch. The unholy trinity of record companies EMI, A&M and Virgin hadn't yet had the pleasure of their company, nor check their back pockets to find that they had hundreds of thousands of pounds filched. Destroy! 21 years later, I was working as an actor in Germany on a regular TV show, travelling to Munich every weekend. I had a driver, a jovial, garrulous bear of a man called Ossi, who always collected me at the airport and drove me to the TV studio, and then did the reverse journey when I was travelling back to London. After our last show before the summer break, I asked him what he would be doing through the summer, and he replied that he would be driving bands around different outdoor festivals in Germany. "Oh, that sounds fun," I said. "Who's coming over?" "Oh, yeah, I shall be driving Sex Pistols for their reunion tour. Yeah." I knew that the Pistols had reformed for this reunion tour, and the rumour was that they would get £1 million each for the summer. I took out a pen and scrawled a message for Johnny Rotten. I wrote, "Dear Johnny, I've just been going through the pockets of a pair of trousers I haven't worn since you supported me in Middlesbrough in 1976. I'm afraid to say that approximately £12 seems to be missing. If you know anything about the matter, would you kindly settle with Ossie? Best wishes, Richard Kidd Strange." I gave it to Ossie and asked him to give it to Johnny Rotten at an appropriate moment. In September, when I returned to Munich, Ossie was waiting for me at the airport, as usual. In the car, I said, "Hey, how was your summer?" And he said, "Oh, yeah, it was great. Lots of festivals and lots of fun. Oh, by the way, I have a letter for you." He slipped a tatty envelope over his shoulder to me in the back of the car as he drove. Inside, in ragged handwriting, was a short note. "Dear Kid, yeah, sorry about that. I do remember something. Hope this will cover it. All the best, John Lydon." Attached to the letter was a crisp new $50 bill and a receipt on which he'd written, "Paid in full." It was quite a nice touch and rather endearing. When I told Malcolm about it, he laughed. He said, "But I'm sure it was Steve who nicked all the money that night." For our second album, the archly named Figments of Emancipation, we talked Brian and Polydor into putting us into the most famous recording studio in the world, EMI Studios in Abbey Road in northwest London. It was where many of the classic rock albums were made, including, of course, The Beatles' Revolver and Sgt. Pepper, and Pink Floyd's Dark Side of the Moon. Renee and I had been there as sitters-in on countless late-night Roy Harper sessions in the late 60s and early 70s. While Peter Jenner rolled spliffs and produced the records, in that order of priority, John Leckie was the engineer, and we got to know him well. I managed to coerce Leckie into producing the record for us for a reduced fee, and since he was a friend of long standing, I knew that I could trust him with the important second album. It was the fulfillment of any music fan's lifelong fantasy to actually record their own album there. Apart from Abbey Road's preeminence as a studio, there was another reason I wanted to record in that part of London. Renee was by now at the point of giving birth, and I wanted to be near the Royal Free Hospital in Hampstead when the call came. Against the prevailing musical tide at the time, we were going in the studio to make an album of 6 long songs rather than an album of 15 short ones. The songs were the 12-minute-plus Brothers Suicide City, Marie and Joe, Perfect Past, In Camera, Doctors of Madness, and Out. The sound on this record was much bigger and weightier than on the first album. In studios, as in most things, you get what you pay for, I guess. We were paying something in the region of £120 an hour for Abbey Road, so we needed to be well rehearsed before we even went into the studio to begin recording. One of my favourite songs on the album is Marie and Joe. Lyrically and vocally, it owes a lot to Lou Reed in one of his more tender moments. It tells the story of two people not having an affair, but nevertheless the yearning and aching of the unconsummated lust is quite neurotic. I admit it's not exactly White Riot or Anarchy in the UK, but that song meant a lot to me at the time.
Marie's telling Joe he left my breakfast on a mirror with a blade, but not a word why he's gone. And Joe rolls his eyes, tries to feel a bit less helpless, but the late night TV movie makes him smile. He says, "You've never been in love, you just read all the books about how it should feel, and it all seems so awful. Now he's gone. Listen, you ought to be like me, just get what you can, that way you know it's real. It saves all the heartbreak later on.
Musically, I thought it was exquisitely languid, building through the verse in some achingly beautiful bass player from Stoner, and a great guitar solo too, played by Urban Blitz. What was essentially an acoustic song was transformed by the way Stoner and Urban Blitz took it by the scruff of the neck and magnificently kicked the living daylights out of it. Stoner and Peter provided some very nice vocal harmonies too, which lifted the later choruses and made the song soar. The linchpin of the album was the two-song segue of Brothers and Suicide City. Brothers was an affectionate look at the way the lives of myself and my two brothers had diverged. Suicide City was a gaze into the abyss, provoked by an evening that I spent with Rini and Jacqueline, my 1966 French flame. In the song, they are referred to as the Giants. And so it was when I spoke with the Giants with the night of summer turning cold on our skin. And the talk turned to strangers and doctors of madness, and to those on the outside who tried to get in. On the chorus coda, we were joined by three female vocalists, Jill McIntosh, Stephanie DeSykes and Claire Torrey. Stephanie had had a few bubblegum hits in the early 70s and became a session singer. Claire had been around for quite a while and had reached her apotheosis with her magnificent scat singing on Pink Floyd's Dark Side of the Moon. Claire is that howling, haunting, pleading female voice that is heard emerging through the album and which makes the record something very special. John Leckie had worked with her as an engineer, so he knew Claire, and he was able to get her to work for us. These three girls also sang on another of the songs that we'd recorded for Figments of Emancipation, a straightforward love ballad called Perfect Past, the song that I'd sung as a duet with Twiggy on her TV show. It was Brian Morrison's favourite song, and it always reduced him to a quivering-lipped adolescent.
Make your dreams the perfect past. Perfect scene to never last. Watch the scenes that move so fast.
We were about a couple of weeks into the recording session on May the 31st. It was a bank holiday, and we were doing some drum overdubs on one of the tracks when the telephone rang in the studio. It was Reen saying that she'd gone into labour and was on her way to hospital. I reckoned I had a couple of hours before there would be any real need for me to be at the hospital, so I stayed at the studio, exhorting Peter to get those overdubs right, as they were costing us 120 quid an hour. The drum overdubs complete, I told John Leckie to get on with Urban Blitz's overdub guitar parts, and one of the roadies drove me to the Royal Free Hospital. When I arrived, Reenie was already in bed, moderately comfortable, but the contractions were coming more and more frequently. Events seemed to accelerate through the afternoon, and by early evening, amid the maelstrom of Reen's howling and swearing, our screaming son was born. I was at the bedside, and in the excitement and the emotion of the moment, I promptly fainted and had to be taken next door to be revived. Very bad for the image of the macho rock and roller. When I came round and returned to Reen's bedside, she was laying in bed with a rosy-cheeked approximation of the Michelin man, who looked about 80 years old with a few tufts of hair on his cannonball head. The nurse, a fabulous, hearty Caribbean woman whom you would trust with your life, desperately wanted to say that the child was a spitting image of her dad, but as I stood there, ashen, blue-haired and skeletal, she could only say, "He's got big hands like you." Brian and Greta Morrison arrived at the hospital within minutes of the infant's birth, armed with a bottle of champagne to toast mother and baby. For some inexplicable reason, Reen was not in the mood for a drink, so we drained the bottle between the three of us before Morrison only half-jokingly said, "I hope they're fucking working at Abbey Road while you're here, my son. It's cost me £120 an hour." When Morrison and Greta left, I stayed a while longer with Reen until she needed sleep and attention and the baby was whisked off to be weighed and washed and checked over. I returned to the studio, emotionally drained but excited and thankful that the baby was fit and well. We'd already discussed names for children and we knew what he would be called. Reenie was a big fan of the Irish writer Edna O'Brien, and we called our son Eugene, who we nicknamed Gino, after the hero in O'Brien's The Country Girls trilogy. His second name was Eyre, which was Reen's family name. I continued the recording of the album with daily breaks for hospital visits until Reenie and Eugene were discharged. 1976 was a long, hot, golden summer that started in May and seemed to last forever. I'd never felt so alive or so excited in my life. To be doing good work, to have a wonderful partner and a healthy son, I felt that I was blessed. We recorded three rock songs, Doctors of Madness, which we'd not managed to nail with John Punter first time round, Out, which was like a fourth part to the Mitz's Cure trilogy from the album. Curiously, it was named by Joe Elliott, vocalist with the megastars Def Leppard, as being one of his three favourite songs ever. And In Camera, the song I'd written for Bill Nelson. Working with Lecky was an absolute joy. Not only was he a producer full of great creative ideas and the technical ability to apply them, but he was also a man totally without ego or neurosis. It's this combination of qualities that has made him one of the greatest and most successful producers in the world. I'm proud that I was the first person to engage him solely as a producer. He's subsequently gone on to produce such great albums as Radiohead's The Bends, The Stone Roses' enormously influential first album, as well as Simple Minds, Spiritualized, Cowboy Junkies, Cooler Shaker, The Fall, The Verb, blah, 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 blah. No sooner had we finished mixing the album than we were back on the road doing gigs all over the UK to keep our profile up. Morrison had the idea that Reenie and I should take Eugene down for a day at the races at Royal Ascot, convinced that we would get our photograph into the papers. Since Royal Ascot is one of the great social events of the year, Morrison rightly reckoned that the sight of a blue-haired stick insect holding a baby in the royal enclosure was bound to be worth a couple of column inches in Nigel Dempster's diary. I hired a morning suit and a topper from Moss Bros, and Morrie gave us a few quid to spend on champagne and strawberries. It was actually quite a hoot, and Eugene was as good as gold. That night, the doctors were supporting Ian Dury's band, Kilburn and the High Roads, in Sheffield. So as soon as we knew we'd been snapped at the races, we headed home. I changed out of the hired suit in the lavatory of the train and emerged like Clark Kent, dressed in the more familiar attire of tight jeans and a leather jacket. Summer's not a great time to tour the towns and cities of Britain, dusty and hot there, for the most part empty of record-buying public. So Martin Hopewell hit on the idea of sending us all around the British seaside resorts for the summer. The weather that year was unforgettably good. The sun seemed to shine for months on end, and we enjoyed ourselves, feeling that we'd recorded an album that was really going to give our career a lift up to the next level. All through that blistering summer, though, I felt that we were being stalked by punk, like an assassin waiting to kill us off.